You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake, and today we are honored to have Bill Fells with us, rancher, local rancher, and I've been hoping to get Bill for some time. I know how busy he is, and what were you up to today, Bill?
Mostly I've been plowing a field to reseed a fresher crop of alfalfa next spring.
Good. I don't think a lot of people realize how much work a ranching life entails. And I'm hoping today that we can enlighten them a little bit.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
It really is.
There's no question about it.
For sure. What part did the cycles on the land play? You know, it's coming into between summer and fall, really, and fall and winter, mm-hmm. the way the weather's been. So what is your work involve in making those preparations?
Well, I mean, obviously, each season brings its own jobs that we do. And right now, we've just finished up a couple of weeks ago gathering our cows off the forest. And now we've been vaccinating them and getting them ready to be weaned, and then getting some other fall work done. And the last few days I've been plowing a field right along the highway so I can reseed it next spring.
And you have a cow-calf operation, is that correct?
That's correct.
Right.
Meaning by that we have a base herd of our cows. They're basically our factory, and each year they produce a calf for me, and then I'll sell a few of the older cows or a few of the lower producing cows and replace them with a few of the better looking heifer calves.
And then when you do sell them on the market, it just depends on the market price, doesn't it?
Well, most of my calves, I was really fortunate in the past working with Ty Jacober and Crystal River Meats. They've had their economic difficulties, so now I joined a co-op out of the Pacific Northwest, Country Natural Beef, and so our calves will end up at Whole Foods again.
All right. That sounds really good. You know, the one thing I've always been impressed with you, Bill, is your involvement in the Thompson Divide Coalition. And recently, the CORE Act passed the House. Whether or not it's going to be approved by the Senate or changed or not, we don't know, but could you tell us a little bit about why you were really involved with that and what you think about the progress that's been made?
Oh, it was easy. I mean, our grazing permits of ours and all the Nicelandic family and a few others is the heart of Thompson Divide, and all of us felt that it would really have a lot of negative impacts on our Forest Service permits if there was oil and gas developed. But the community has just been amazing. It's one of these issues that took a village to work on, and boy, did the community of Carbondale step forward and really engage and really make this a united, just overwhelmingly unanimous voice from this valley to protect Thompson Divide.
Right, and you know, it was a privilege to be involved on the oil and gas EIS to determine the future of that area, at least for the next 20 years, unless it's overruled. And that's a case of where the Forest Service listened to people, went to the meetings and discovered it was unanimously from the community against it, and actually made a decision, no more future leasing in the Thompson Divide area. Of course, that could be overturned by a presidential action or a Congress, but I'm proud to be associated with that environmental assessment that made that decision. That was a local decision based on the local input, and people can have an influence on politics in the case of public meetings on issues like that.
I don't think when everyone working on it started, we envisioned that we would have congressional action. I mean, maybe at least I was certainly naive, and then I really took a back seat, and a lot of other people really stepped up and made it happen. But it's fantastic to have it passed through Congress. It's tough to see anything happening in Washington right now for the Senate to get it done, but we can work on it and keep working.
And keep hoping that things do get better, that's for sure. Well, you know, there are other issues when you have a ranch like you do, the Cold Mountain Ranch, and that is going through these public agencies and having grazing permits. That requires a lot of work, especially a lot of paperwork, doesn't it?
Oh, we have a really good relationship with our Forest Service local staff, from Scott and supervisor on down to Sammy, our range conservation officer, and they're good to work with.
It's good. That's good to hear. I know too that there are certain issues that state issues that are involved in water rights on your place too, and I read an article a while back that you were having some difficulty in water rights. Could you help us with that a little bit, understanding that?
Well, obviously, water is critical to any sort of agricultural production in this arid West. I mean, you know, we could not exist without our water rights. The problem throughout the West is we have more and more and more people, and certainly a supply of water that's not increasing. And if you listen to the climate scientists, will be decreasing. And so we've got more and more people fighting over a scarcer and scarcer resource. And so we were trying to come up with a trial effort to see if it could be part of the solution, because we certainly don't have the votes. Colorado doesn't have the votes. California is going to have a major impact on what happens to water in the West.
They really are, because of their population and influence in Congress, aren't they?
Yeah, no, it's scary. And that's a subject that you could talk for weeks, but and there's some great local people who could talk on it, but it's a really complex issue. But we need to, I'd rather be trying to be at the table and make the decision instead of be on the plate and be eaten.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. You know, I notice on your ranch you do use a lot of water conservation measures, like your irrigation and that sort of thing. So it's a matter of conservation of the land from the position you're in, of trying to make sure that the water is used appropriately, and what you don't use gets returned back in the stream and for inflow stream flows, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's so complex. I've tried to analyze different systems of water, and it's a really tough issue. I mean, we could put in a big center pivot sprinkler and use less water. I am not at all convinced that I could grow as much hay under a center pivot as I could by flood irrigating. I know I'd have a big carbon footprint because I'd have to pump all of that water to do it, that right now I just use gravity, as well as we'd have a lot smaller river this time of year, because my water that I've flood irrigated all summer is still seeping back through the sponge of the valley floor and filling the river this time of year.
Right, for sure. You know, there's another local issue that's complicated, quite complicated, that I'd like to talk with you about, and that's the wolf reintroduction into Colorado. And what are some of your views on that, Bill?
It terrifies me, in one or two words. I don't know why we're doing it. Most of the people who are advocating for wolf reintroduction look and say, well, look at Yellowstone. The wolves have really helped. But Yellowstone was totally mismanaged. It's a totally different ecosystem than we have here. Wolves there were really instrumental in restoring the riparian zones that the elk had overgrazed. But no one has, that I've seen, has pointed to riparian areas in western Colorado that the elk are overgrazing. And if we do have an issue with some of those riparians, I would probably try beavers as a better keystone species to build their population, to bring back wolves. I mean, why would be my first question.
Okay, that's reasonable.
is why do we want them? If we just want to restore the same animal population that we had 150 years ago in western Colorado, well, most of us will have to start packing and move out, because it's so different. And to compare us to Yellowstone is crazy. The Maroon Bell Snowmass Wilderness is 1/12 the size of Yellowstone, and yet we have the same number of backcountry hikers and campers, 140,000 a year, as Yellowstone. You know, additionally, there's 300,000 visitors to Maroon Lake here.
Right. You know, and also you take an area like the Flat Tops. It's just not big enough of an ecosystem to handle the wolves. They could be up there in the summer. They're going to be down in the lower elevations where the ranches are in the wintertime.
Yeah, I mean, the wolves will follow their prey, like any predator. And the deer and elk come down, and the horror stories we hear from ranchers who are dealing with them, both currently and historically, we just think it's a lose-lose situation, and that we just, why is the first question. The deer and elk population here are already really in trouble. I know the Division of Parks and Wildlife is engaged on a 6-year study right now because their cow-calf ratio is so low. It's in the 20s, and they want it in the upper 40s, you know, the number of calves per 100 cows. We have maybe 10% of the deer that we used to have 30 years ago. There are lots of factors hurting the deer and elk population from predators. We have a lot more predators. We have an amazing amount of recreation that's displacing them from the range. We have loss of habitat. We have highways and fences. All those factors conspire against them, and to take a population of those deer and elk that's already in trouble and add wolves just doesn't make sense to me.
You know, if you've been around here very long at all, used to be a few years back, you could go between Rifle and Meeker at night and be really concerned about hitting a deer. And I've been through there a lot lately and hardly seen any deer in there, daylight or night at all. So I think, you know, that decrease in population is a serious issue.
30 years ago, going up my driveway this time of year, my friend Randy Udall call it the Serengeti, because I would have 300 deer in the field. I don't think I've had 30 at any one time in the last 2 years. I mean, we have 10% of what we used to have.
Right. And some people address the what I would call the myth that wolves only take down the sick and the those animals in trouble.
It's pretty frustrating to debate them when they don't really go on the facts. They just say, "Oh, you just have myths. We have science," and I just don't think that's true. Let's have an honest debate looking at the situations. Let's look why we want to do it. Let's compare Colorado with its 5.5 million people, many of them who are amazing recreationists, are out in the woods all the time, to the 1 million of humans in Montana, or the 500,000 in Wyoming. You know, the Colorado that existed 150 years ago when wolves were here does not exist today.
It really doesn't. And also, you look at the grizzly too. Going to bring the wolves back, bring the grizzly back, and they certainly don't have enough territory in our area here.
No, they just don't. And we've been, and especially my wife Marge has really been working a lot learning about wolves and the avoidance strategies that they talk about to keep the wolves from predating on your cattle are defenders of wildlife who are big wolf proponents readily admit that those avoidance strategies don't work on large-scale land areas. They don't even work on small-scale areas for a very long time. But, you know, some of our cows are up in some pretty pristine wilderness, and some of the avoidance strategies are setting off sirens and strobe lights all night long. I don't think that's going to make us any more popular with the public who's out there trying to enjoy a nice time in the wilderness and to have sirens and strobe lights go off all through the night.
Right, for sure. You know, one of the issues, too, about wilderness is that there are some people that just don't want to see any cattle in wilderness at all. And yet, at this point, recreation can coexist with ranching, can coexist with a lot of things. But as it increases in number, the recreation problem is going to become almost an industrial problem. And so, you know, it's not an issue of not having cattle in the wilderness so much it is not having more people.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's coming in the future. I think that's already here. Certainly on the crown, on the east side of this valley, the mountain bikers have become the dominant land use to the detriment of wildlife.
Right, for sure. And putting a lot of illegal trails in doesn't help, does it?
Not to me.
One thing I've really admired about you, Bill, is the fact that your land is involved in the Aspen Valley Land Trust with some conservation easements. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I really like Aspen Valley Land Trust, AVLT. Actually, our land here on the Crystal, we placed under easement with a helper of Pitkin County, their open space and trails budget, and the commissioners, and the Colorado Cattlemen's Agricultural Land Trust, which is an organization I've been involved with since it started 25 years ago. And it's now the largest land trust in the state of Colorado. It has about 630,000 acres of land protected by productive agricultural land protected by conservation easements.
And we're losing a lot of our farming land in Colorado, too. I don't know, have the exact figures, but what benefits does it have for you for entering a conservation easement?
Well, obviously, there were some financial benefits. The Pitkin County and actually Great Outdoors Colorado purchased our conservation easement from us. But the main benefit for us, for my family, is knowing that that land will never be developed and always be available for agriculture. And, you know, for all the benefits that that provides for wildlife, for the viewshed as you drive down the highway, for the how it affects our water quality and everything else. I think there are immense benefits, and we are really thrilled that we were able to do that.
Well, you know, I'm not able to give a whole lot to the Aspen Valley Land Trust, except I enjoy going to the auctions, the land dance, they call it. And I remember that one time you and I were bidding on that two bottles of whiskey that George Stranahan brought in there, and I finally...
Yeah, and I think you won it.
I think...
Paid more.
Yeah, I didn't mind paying more for that at all, because that's a really good cause. And those of you out there listening, you get a chance to go to that when it comes up. Please do, because it really does support the Aspen Land Trust.
AVLT is a great organization. They do a lot of good work locally. The Pitkin County Open Space has worked on a lot of good land in the valley. Great Outdoors Colorado has, you know, they've got a big checkbook too, which has been great. And as I say, their Cattlemen's Agricultural Land Trust has really done incredible work throughout the state of Colorado.
For sure. Absolutely. Doesn't the Crystal Ranch, Crystal Valley Ranch, butt up to your property?
the Crystal River.
Crystal River
Ranch.
Yeah, Crystal River.
They bought some of Marge's dad's ranch, and so that abuts us.
Okay. And they're pretty conservation-minded, too, aren't they?
They're a really great ranch, and that's owned by Sue Anschutz Rogers, and she has Tom Harrington as her manager, and he's doing a great job managing that ranch. I'm not aware that they have any of it, very much of it, protected by a conservation easement.
That might be something to look into for me then, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, there's so many people today that don't have that direct connection to the land like you do, that probably wouldn't know how to help irrigate if their life depended on it. And what kind of recommendations do you have for them that could help them to try to get back in touch with the land?
I know people are, there's a huge thirst for a connection with production. And it's hard. I think personally, I'm a huge fan of apprenticeship. It's certainly how I've learned a lot of the skills that I've been lucky enough to pick up is to apprentice, whether it being a carpenter or working for my father-in-law, Bob Perry, taught me so much about land. But I think for people to connect to it, I think you have to see land through not any one snapshot in time, but see how that land responds to different management, to the different seasons. What gets my blood pumping is the springtime when we're calving and you see that new calf be born and stumble up like a drunk trying to get its legs underneath him and then a few minutes later start nursing on his mother. If that doesn't make you excited, I don't know what would.
That's a really good analogy. My excitement came for when I was able to hunt on the land and just getting in that routine of coming up before the sun's up and staying till it goes down and not having to schedule or have to do something except to be out there on the land is something that always motivated me for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, what motivated me was an occupation that could keep me outdoors. Almost all the time. There's a little too much paperwork now, but being outdoors all the time instead of cooped up in an office in front of a computer screen, there's no comparison.
ain't that the truth? Well, listen, Bill, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate you coming on to the show. This is KDNK's For Land's Sake Public Affairs program. And for those of you listening, whatever you do to Mother Nature, please do it for land's sake. Until next time, have a good day.